Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
We're going to close the series today, and we're recording this on May the 13th. We're going to close the series today with looking at universities in the future. And Graham and I are going to have possibly a little bit more of an interchange in the sense that I've rather hogged the spotlight so far. And obviously, we are commenting on the future, but as it were, the near future also plays a role because, in a sense, the condition and situation in universities at the present moment is being pushed to the fore by political activism there. But let's start by winding back and reprising a couple of comments we made right at the very beginning. One being that what happens in Britain does, or for that matter, the United States, does not define the situation in higher education across the world. And that in most countries in the world, higher education is very different to the situation in Britain, in that it is much more prominently under the control of the state. And therefore, market issues, market solutions, the, as it were, independent financing of universities is not quite the issue when they are a branch of either national or regional government. So that's point number one. Point number two we made is that there are a whole host of stakeholders, to use an ugly modern phrase, the image of somebody going around with a bit of sirloin and somebody else, me, with a bit of rump and somebody else with a bit of T-bone. But anyway, there are a whole host of stakeholders. And just to make it clear, I do know they're spelt differently. And these stakeholders inevitably have contrasting views, contrasting interests, and it cannot therefore but be anticipated that whatever solutions are suggested will be greeted with some with the weary shrug of the shoulder of "that's obvious," and by others with high dudgeon and outrage. So we take that for granted. Then moving more specifically to the British case, let me again frame the basic parameter, which is the anticipation in universities by variously management, staff and students that there should be more money in order to fund them and in order not to make them have to face really harsh choices is unlikely. It's unlikely whether the current government maintains power, which is even more unlikely, and it's unlikely if Labour comes into power, not least because Labour also will have enormous financial concerns, and also because it has already argued the need for putting more funding into tertiary education of the vocational type. So in other words, I'm going to say things which people won't like to hear and they'll express outrage. I've already had a number of emails expressing outrage, much I care. And the point being that all of these people who've corresponded with me have assumed there should be more public funding. But if you can't see public funding as likely to come, it doesn't really help if you plan for something that is unlikely. And on top of that, as I already indicated, fresh goes at the money markets are in terms of borrowing, either in bank loans or bond issues, might work in one or two cases for very asset-rich institutions which have land as their basic surety. You know, we're thinking here of Oxford and Cambridge, but won't work for most places, and that the borrowing environment is deteriorating both because of higher interest rates and because the risk element is affected by international differences and strain, which makes it less likely that people will be able to fill their holes with Chinese students in order to get out of difficulty in that respect. So those are the basic parameters. Okay, Graham, do you agree that those are the basic parameters, or do you think I've got it hopelessly wrong?
No, very much so. I mean, ultimately, the future finance of higher education will determine what happens and whether it expands, whether it contracts, whether it just finds a way of admitting more and more international students to pay its way, or whether it not only contracts, but it is allowed to contract by government, because there's a political dimension to all of that.
Yes, and I think that last point, that there is a political dimension, is absolutely fundamental. And the political dimension is not just at the level of the constituent parts of the United Kingdom. And obviously there are and have been different strategies in Edinburgh and Cardiff, for example. And here I'm talking principally about the English system, but also insofar as higher education may play a more prominent role in whatever may be devolved to regional governments, that will be an issue as well. And I've already raised the point that if you're, let's say, running Lincolnshire, you're not likely to be pleased to be told that the University of Lincoln is, shall we say, has less to offer the country than the University of Nottingham. A, you may doubt it, and B, even if you agree with it privately, it would not be politically expedient to adopt that approach. So yes, politics and the perception of politics is going to be important. And apropos of that, I think it's fair to say that although they're only a minority that are involved, minorities of both students and staff that take part in political activism, particularly if that political activism is intimidatory or even more violent, are not going to help the cause as a whole. Now, let me be clear about this. This is only a minority of students. I mean, in the 1930s, far more students at Cambridge were interested in cricket than were interested in communism. But it doesn't matter. Perception is a significant element of the situation. And I mean, for example, I know that in Exeter, the differential rates in which subject staff went on strike during the UCU strikes last year and the previous year played a role, without a doubt, in attitudes of management towards which branches of the university to, as it were, expand and which branches not to expand. And it would be naive to imagine that the same would not be true elsewhere. So that element is going to play a role, and I suspect there will be more political activism, not only or specifically about the Palestinian issue, which may well rise to a crescendo later this year, I don't know, but actually the very fact that that pattern has been established may well encourage other such activism, though it's also worth bearing in mind that activism is very selective. As we know at the moment, there are large numbers of civilians being murdered in Darfur, in Sudan, in sectarian and ethnic violence within Sudan, and I don't recall any significant student or other public agitation. Clearly, that doesn't seem to upset people. But nevertheless, there may well be other issues that come to the fore. So where do we go from here? Now, I mentioned that if you have problems with funding, most common solutions, and they're not incompatible, is to cut staff, cut services, and sell assets, which are principally land. And I think that that is what is going to happen. Selling of land, well, clearly this will coincide with governmental policies about having more housing, because university land is overwhelmingly located in or close to major urban areas, very different from a landowner's institutional landowners such as the Crown, for example, which is largely in rural areas. And a lot of the buildings on the urban estate of universities is low grade, architecturally in merit. Much of it is going to need replacing anyway over the next 30 to 50 years, because much of it was built in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s with no real expectation that it would last for a long time. And a lot of it was built in mass-produced systems and on top of that with flat roofs. So it's a lot of this is going to be obsolescent. And that raises the question whether it should be replaced by light-by-light buildings or just simply these buildings should not be replaced. If replaced by light-by-light, there's going to be need for fresh borrowing or fresh governmental grant, neither of which one could see. And one way we could look at this is to say that maybe universities as a rule, I'm not talking, as I've said, about Oxford and Cambridge, because they are treated as a different, as the fifth wheel on the car, but maybe universities as a whole don't need to have accommodation for students or should generally wind it down or only offer it in special case scenarios or particular subjects or particular categories. That, of course, it can be subject to discussion, but nevertheless, that would release an enormous amount of land for sale, and possibly that is the way forward and is possibly better than the sort of deals with developers that were part of the norm among in the last quarter century. Anyway, there is a considerable potential in that respect for releasing funds for many institutions. And on top of that, as I also mentioned, there is a lot of opportunity for merging institutions that are nearby, particularly if in the same city. And I've already mentioned, you can see that very clearly when sites are contiguous, Newcastle and Northumbria, for example, or Manchester or Manchester Metropolitan, or indeed when there are sites in the same city that are not contiguous, but where you don't necessarily need two of every branch of administration. So you can see this in a whole range of places, you know, Sheffield, for example, or Leeds, Birmingham, and so on and so forth. So that, again, it's not that scale is necessarily better. I don't think scale is necessarily better, but I think certainly it represents an opportunity to save on a lot of money being currently spent on administration. Much of it is spent very poorly. So that is, you know, in term, and of course, the fewer administrative departments you have on the whole, the fewer buildings you need for them. So again, that is represents a way to save. Now, we then look at the next one, size of teaching staff and size of the services provided. If we take the second one first, we have had experience in Britain with subjects like earth sciences, i.e. geology, and classics, and they're by no means the only subjects, in determining a form of national rationalization. We only need or can afford X number of institutions teaching these subjects, and we're not going to fund them elsewhere. That is now not the case so readily because, of course, the universities, rather than a university grants council or funding council, are the key elements. But nevertheless, it's certainly something that could be encouraged for smaller subjects. Better to have a fewer number of institutions teaching those where the subjects are stronger than a large number of those which are weaker. And that, again, is something that I think deserves serious concern. There are, after all, clear attractions of scale here. If you have an archaeology department of four members of staff, you can offer far fewer courses to the pupils than if you have an archaeology department of 10 members of staff. And if what that means is you close down two other archaeology departments, also each of four members of staff, it is not necessarily a national calamity, however much that might be presented. And that links into the broader question of the size of the staff. And of course, we've already discussed the extent to which we have a large number of staff, far greater number of staff than were available to teach in universities, not just in the 1950s or 60s, but even much more recently than that. And obviously the number of students has increased, which raises questions about whether always this expansion has been sensible, number one. Number two, whether you need the current in practice pro rata tariffs that exist for teaching in many subjects. And number three, whether if you feel you should have a certain pro rata tariff, whether it needs to be paid at the seniority levels that are currently done. I mean, do you need departments with quite so many professors, or even with many professors, particularly if those departments are primarily teaching departments for undergraduates. And that, again, is something that I think should be looked at very seriously, because these are all causes of expenditure that isn't merited, however much it's pleasant for people to feel that they merit a particular rank. These are forms of expenditure that aren't particularly merited, but that add to the aggregate cost of teaching that particular subject. Now, clearly, if you are teaching an area in which you can achieve significant revenues from research income or foreign postgraduates, that's a different position. But again, if you are, that still raises the question about how sensible it is to give people what in fact is implicit continuity of service, rather than, as it were, only for the period of time when they are producing that income yield. So that again is something that needs seriously to be considered. Now, what that might do, I mean, I'm a historian by background. People could easily say to me, well, isn't this going to be terrible for a subject like history or English literature? Well, I've already discussed, and I do urge people not to listen simply to one programme, but to listen to the lot, because they do fit together. I've already argued that in the case of a subject like history, much of the effective teaching and research is done outside the university context, and I would say the same is true more generally in the arts and social sciences. I've also argued that they don't need to be the size they are at the moment. I remember in the 1990s when I was involved in discussions about departmental size, and there was a lot of acrimony, and I remarked once that Moses didn't come down Mount Sinai saying the size of the history department ought to be 19 members of staff. That was in Exeter. It's now over 60. And I'm not sure that one would necessarily argue that that has been commensurate with either the quality of staff appointment or the quality of teaching. Nothing specific about Exeter there. I think this is more generally the case in the system. Periods of major expansion are often periods associated with a decline of quality. That was very much seen in the 1960s and early 70s, for example. I would argue you could also say it was seen in the 2000s and early two teens. Others may have a different point of view. And obviously, it's not always easy to measure. But on the other hand, I think it can be fairly said that if you have significant expansion, then people are going to be appointed who would not have been appointed at other times. And that itself is a matter that invites reflection. So there is that element of it, that there is no fixed size for places, and that larger isn't necessarily better, although it can mean that you can teach larger numbers of students in smaller groups. And again, there is the question of whether that is particularly the most sensible way to do it, given that there is only X amount of money available. Now, the present way this is done in most universities is to offer more detailed teaching in smaller groups to third years and more large scale groups in the first years on the whole. And of course, even smaller groups if you move on to a master's and a doctorate. And that, I suppose, is a sensible way to proceed, but it does sometimes raise the question as to whether, in practical terms, given future likely funding levels, this should not mean that there's more flexibility towards larger group teaching. And if you're going towards larger group teaching with inevitably less of a provision of of marking, for example, and less of a provision of personal interaction, you have to then raise the question of what precisely is the point of university for non-vocational subjects, or certainly university for so many people for non-vocational subjects. And you can then take that a stage further. If people are living at home and going to their local university, why not treat that as a form of evening class for those that are keen on the subject, and actually sandwich it in with the working week? I've also already raised the point, which has long, long, long seemed obvious to me, that we really ought to abandon this idea of three terms and massive vacations, and instead think more seriously, if we're going to have residential universities, and I underline the if, thinking much more seriously of two-year, four-term-a-year institutions, with students therefore needing to secure support for themselves for a shorter period of time. There will always be some subjects, medicine obviously, physics these days, that require more time, and those therefore, if they're in the national interest, should be funded accordingly. But at the present moment, it's a little difficult to see why it is in the national interest for students to have such a long period of time on vacation. I was once in a meeting with David Willetts, the Conservative higher education figure, and there were seven academics there, there were three from Oxbridge who were complaining bitterly that they weren't even better looked after, and there were four from elsewhere. And the three had their say first, and Willetts turned to me and said, "Well, what do you think about that?" And I said, "Well, I said it's rather difficult, Minister, to take a view that an institution that is open to undergraduates less than half the year should really be regarded as a university." And he laughed and said, "Yes, his son had a much worse education at Cambridge than his son's friend at Stanford." And I mean, that more general point is one that I think is worth considering. I mean, in other words, legacy platforms, legacy systems may be very, very, very attractive, and a lot of people may enjoy them, but unless somebody's going to explain how they can be funded, I think one has to be very careful of assuming that they should set norms. Over to you, Graham.
Well, thank you, Jeremy. I mean, I'm just, as you're talking, I'm just thinking, I mean, Buckingham University, which of course is a private university, has introduced shorter academic terms. You can do a degree in 2 years there. That doesn't seem to have taken off at the public universities, and I'm just wondering what the perhaps perverse incentives are which pull against reform of this kind, and really whether in fact almost everything pushes universities towards always becoming bigger, always taking in more students in order to get the fees and the funding that comes with more students, always having more academics, always having more papers written to get the research funding, regardless of actually the real quality of some of the research being undertaken. Is it just that there are too many incentives to just continue along the path universities have been down these last few decades? And unless that model is somehow broken, there won't really be meaningful reform.
Well, I think that's probably true. The broken is a difficult word to use. I mean, I think it is, in a sense, not working at the present moment because indebtedness is so high. And, you know, in one respect, it's a Ponzi scheme on the taxpayer and the Treasury, which is why the Treasury repeatedly complains about the enormous amount of student debt that has government-backed student debt that is out there. And I think that is a very serious issue. I think it's made more serious by the fact that, as I was discussing yesterday, a lot of primary schools are desperately short of money, and it's a little difficult to understand, if you only have X amount of money, why you're spending it on, shall we say, some of the more curious things that get funded for either teaching or research in universities. and not in primary schools where there is a national obligation to educate everybody. So yes, I mean, it may be the case that the threat of insolvency forces institutions to merge, cut, or realize their assets. I mean, there have already been, I don't think it's any secret, problems in terms of the bank that's lending money, putting pressure on Kent. I think there's no secret there's been problems at East Anglia, a good university, but there have been problems there. And one can expect these to become more commonplace. I imagine at the present moment, many of the universities are hoping that Labour comes in and discovers vast sums of money. And if they do that, then the current system will just stumble on as is. I don't think that's a particularly good idea, but it's always easier, of course, to keep a rotten system going than to try and improve it.
Well, one of the things that has helped a rotten system keep going and keep expanding is the admission of international students who pay higher fees than domestic students do. Is this something that, in the absence of a desire either to cut back or sell off assets, and also the unlikelihood of the next government allowing fees for domestic students to rise? Is it just the case that, in the absence of anything else, the role of the international student market will just continue to grow and grow until it will be commonplace for most universities to be 50% or more international students?
Well, I'm not sure actually. I mean, you could argue that the idea of doing so will only appeal to particular cohorts in particular countries, that there may well be a change in Chinese policy. China has indicated it would prefer more of its students to stay home. I simply don't know. Clearly, international students bring an enormous amount of money into both universities and the country, which is a good thing. They export British soft power, which is a good thing. And they cross-subsidize very strongly domestic students, which is a good thing given the nature of many universities' finances. So, on the whole, as long as one takes care to make sure that one isn't allowing people to come in for inadequate courses and or use it for immigration event control evasion, on the whole, it is a positive. But it is also, of course, a unreliable form of financing, and the extent to which so many universities are dependent on it is a question mark against their financial model, which presumably their lenders have a view on. If obviously they've got all their costs covered and they're just doing it and they're not needing to borrow, that's one thing. If on the other hand they've borrowed against this revenue source, then one hopes that the risk has been adequately guaranteed and discounted.
Well, that's a very good question. One does hope. I want to ask about how you see the universities in the coming decades, how they are swinging more towards the sciences, the STEM subjects, and away from humanities, partly because the funding is more in the sciences, partly because there seems to be a trend amongst younger people to want to study the sciences rather than the humanities. So there's the perception that there's also better job prospects if you study STEM subjects, but also because now the international market is very sizable for many, indeed for most British universities, the majority of those international students are also focused on STEM subjects rather than art subjects. Should we therefore look to a future of universities in which they are increasingly weighted towards the sciences and the humanities? If I'm not suggesting they die, but they certainly wither on the vine.
Well, again, I think that's a very interesting question. First of all, STEM subjects are doing well. Of course, the real cost is not passed on to the student, because there's certainly at undergraduate level for domestic students, because there's the same cost per subject. And as you're probably aware, STEM subjects are more expensive. And one of the reasons historically universities, as I have explained, have expanded humanities and social sciences is to cross-subsidize the STEM subjects. If more students do STEM subjects, that's probably good for the country. That doesn't mean that non-STEM subjects are bad. It's just probably good for the country. And it may well be the case that vocationalism leads people in that direction. I mean, after all, this isn't necessarily something that's particularly new or restricted to higher education. I've been told that in the secondary school I went to, overwhelmingly, students are doing subjects that lead towards law, accountancy and medicine, because those are seen as ones that are most likely to be able to support them. So I don't think this is necessarily a surprise. And as I've said, given the strength in the country as a whole of interest in many of the subjects of the humanities, I mean, for example, if you think about it, there are a very large number of people who are members of book groups. I would say the flourishing of book groups has done more for an understanding of literary judgment among the public than going to any number of courses on decolonizing literature in departments of history. And you know, you could make analogous remarks about some of the other art subjects and social sciences. So I'm not sure it's necessarily to the intellectual impoverishment of the country. Were it to be the case that you would argue that in some way there are, you know, it's a golden age of people of Hume-like distinction in philosophy departments, etc., you might present it as a national calamity. But I'm not sure that does describe more than a percentage of those people currently teaching these subjects. I don't know. What's your view on the matter?
Well, I think it depends on the humanities subject. I mean, some subjects like English literature are clearly going through a difficult spell in terms of attracting the interest of undergraduates, and yet there doesn't seem to be the same level of cuts to staffing levels. So there's a mismatch there. I think that that's a clear area where English lit departments seem to be in trouble, certainly at many institutions. And I mean, the question for me is whether to what extent that is because of the way English literature is now taught, which is at a very theoretical level.
Yes, I mean, I think that's a polite way of talking about it. Yes, I think there are many problems. And I think it's very interesting if you look at the contrast between the engagement which much of the public has with much of the literature of the past and indeed the present, and the often very opaque way in which it's discussed in courses. Yeah, I think that's right. I think you find in history courses, a lot of students, as one put it to me recently, wanted to find out what had happened and why, and instead of which they felt they were being told, and that was the phrase they used, told what they ought to be angry about. And I think, again, that doesn't describe all history courses, and it certainly doesn't describe all historians. But it is a problem, and it is something worth mentioning. And I think, you know, the argument that the only factor corroding the quality of universities is that of the exigencies of a cruel outside world, expecting them to conform to some sort of financial exigency or model, I think that is naive. I mean, that does exist as a problem. It's a real problem. And in many senses, the managers sold out in a way by taking all the numbers that Blair offered them without realizing adequately that there was going to be a corollary. But there are also practical problems with the intellectual quality and academic purpose of much of the teaching and research that is carried out. And it's naive to ignore that. Now, I have no idea how best to deal with this. And I've already mentioned in, I believe, the first of the programmes, that one has to be wary of more government intervention in order to control the matter. But equally, as I have mentioned, I am very well, I know that it doesn't work to say that one should simply use it to the universities to police themselves, still less farcical bodies like the Arts and Humanities Research Council.
Well, I want to...
Which has financed some most extraordinary things over the years. And extraordinary, I'm thinking here, not in terms of quality.
Yeah, well, I want to draw things to a close by asking where you think this balance between the role of universities having autonomy over their own finances and what they do, and where the balance is between a role for the state. You mentioned at the beginning of this episode that the British experience and the British funding model is different to that in many other countries. I don't detect in Britain much enthusiasm for us moving towards the American system, you know, the cost of fees alone being simply prohibitive for most people in Britain. So if that is ruled out of ever-increasing fees, and yet there is nervousness about a continental system where universities are much more state-directed, what is the course you see for universities in Britain in the coming years?
Well, obviously, I don't know, but I did make the point that given that these are autonomous bodies which have borrowed significant sums of money, and therefore they are not in complete control, and a nationalisation or renationalisation of them would cost a lot of money, I'm not quite sure on the financial side how they can so readily go back under state control. I mean, it's likely to be the case that under a Labour government, as with the academies and other changes in secondary education, which I think have been more successful on the whole than the universities, and again, the contrast between them is instructive, I think there will be an attempt to extend state oversight, but I doubt they'll want to pick up the financial bill. On the other hand, there is the significant financial bill of student student support. So I think that this is a fundamental problem. I mean, in Britain, you know, it looks as though we're going back to Labour, and one has to hope that that does not mean a uncritical acceptance of lowest common denominator public provision. If it does, well, it does. And, you know, I think there are many state systems across Europe, which don't work very well, but which could easily be a model for how the British system operates, with different costing bases, different charges to students, etc., etc. Some of them might be seen as more attractive than others. I dare say we will hear a lot of whether we should be looking to be more Dutch or more German or more French or whatever in our system. I agree with you. I think the political possibility of being more American has long dropped by the wayside. But I think one has to be clear about this, that there are fundamental issues involved in dealing with the liability taken on when it was decided to send so many students to university, and in particular at ensuring that they were given a quality teaching that matched the hopes and aspirations that were embraced. And at the moment, I think there's a certain degree of scepticism about whether this has been secured.
So just on a point of conclusion, Tony Blair's great policy of the 50% of young people going to university is the policy which has imperiled universities.
Well, what I would say is it was naive. It wasn't thought through adequately. It depended on an enormous amount of economic growth. It wasn't linked to an understanding of the changes that would best be brought through to make it actually provide a quality experience. And we've ended up with what isn't a very adequate system. Now, I don't believe I'm not a fan of Tony Blair's, but I don't believe Tony Blair deserves all the blame for this. I think a lot of the blame for it goes to a combination of poor management, indifferent and self-interested academics, And funnily enough, here, an unwillingness to think outside the box. So here you've got somebody not generally noted for his radicalism saying that I think that in the case of higher education, one of the things that went wrong was the attempt to, as it were, just expand on the basis of sameness, and it hasn't worked well.
Well, that's a very clear point on which to end this series about higher education. Professor Jeremy Black, thank you very much for it indeed. And next time we'll be starting a new series on the history of the English town.
Thank you very much.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website www.thecritic.co.uk.